Action! Hello and welcome to episode 381 of the Filmmakers Podcast. I'm Giles Alderson, and this is a podcast on how you make films, basically. This is a special episode today because we have on Dana Kippel. She is the director, the exec producer, writer and star of micro-budget indie film Reflect. She joined me to chat all about how she did it, how she got out there herself, how she raised the money and did what we all say we want to do, is go out there and make your film. She did just that. She talks about what she learnt making Reflect. She talks about addiction and mental health and why she wanted to direct, why having a beginner's mind is sometimes really, really useful, how she wrote the movie Reflect in 2 weeks and crowdfunded and raised finance, not just that way, but also through LinkedIn. She dives into giving direction to fellow actors when you're also acting in it, and why she rushed the edit and release of the film. And we also talk about why you should be kind to yourself as a filmmaker. Dana is an established actress, and recently she has starred in Hellhounds, which has just come out as well. Basically, both her movies that she's starring in, one that she's directing, are releasing now. They're out now. You can watch them, Hellhounds and Reflect. Reflect, the story follows Summer, played by Dana, who's unhappy with a boyfriend. She then receives a mysterious email inviting her out to a spiritual obstacle course. She gathers her four friends, each battling a dilemma of their own. They drive to the Sedona Desert, where they're promised this vortex will improve their lives. The movie stars Grace Patterson, Jade Lynn Greer, Marissa Patterson, Ariana Williams, Corey Brooks, Eric Scott Woods, Dash Katz, Maya Nell, Ryan Jack Connell, and Joe Filippone. And the film's distributor is Cranked Up Films. So this is a real soup to nuts version of how you can go out there and make your film on a micro budget, on pretty much nothing, and go make it, get it distributed, and get it out there in the world. And then go on to make your next film, which is exactly what Dana is doing next. Thank you all so much for your love for Tuesday's episode with the amazing Matthew Vaughan. Argyle is out now in cinemas, do go watch. Obviously, he's the producer slash director of Kick-Ass, Kingsman, Snatch, Lock, Stock, Two Smoking Barrels, Tetris, Rocket Man, etc. List goes on. And your outpouring of love for that episode, because Matthew was so honest and candid about he feels he's still making indie films too, which is correct because he's raising the money himself and paying for it through his company. And therefore he could talk to us as a filmmaker who understood what it was like in the trenches. So if you haven't listened to that, do go listen to the amazing Matthew Vaughan after you've listened to this episode with Dana as well. But appreciate all your love and comments and support. And I've written some of your names down and I will give you shout outs very soon. Coming up on Tuesday, it's very likely to be The Beekeeper. Dom's chat with David Eyre. Yeah, the director and writer of Suicide Squad. Harsh Times, End of Watch, you know, that kind of stuff. He'll be with you on Tuesday, chatting with Dom. So that's going to be another cool episode, I imagine. I haven't edited that one yet. But anyway, don't forget, lovely independent filmmakers that you are, that you, if you're quick and lucky and there's still any left, can get the Shotlister app for free right now. It's worth $99. The Shotlister app is a brilliant app. Which means you don't have to write your shot list on paper. You can draw them on there, they're saved on there, then you can look at them on set and move things around. You can move your schedule around and everything on there. It's an amazing app. And you, because you're listening to the Filmmakers Podcast, can get this for free. The link to that is in the show notes, or you can go to shotlister.com. So get on it now. Don't wait. Just literally click the link, go to the show notes and look at it and click the link and get it before it runs out, because there is only 99 of them. Available. I don't know how many there's left now. Right, I had such a great time chatting with Dana. We've been trying to do it for a little while, but we have done it and really enjoyed each other's company, chatting about filmmaking and how you can do it and the trials and tribulations and everything that goes into it. Dana is wonderfully honest, which makes this a fantastic listen for you. So here it is. This is me, Giles Alderson, chatting to Dana Kippel.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you? It's nice to meet you.
Yes, you. I know. Yeah, you too. I'm good. Just stressed trying to market my first film. It is so stressful.
I know. It's really difficult, isn't it? Especially when you feel like you're on your own. It's like you're just trying to push stuff out and you're worried you're just being in people's faces a lot. But you have to, because if you don't put it out there, no one knows about it.
So. Yes, I'm messaging all my friends from high school, from when I lived in Florida, everyone I know. And I know I'm being so annoying. And I like part of me thinks everyone hates me. And part of me is like, whatever, just keep doing it.
Absolutely. The way I see it is when people do it to you.
Yeah.
Like when they've got a film out, I'm not bothered. I don't mind the press stuff all the time. Same if someone's got a crowdfunder. I felt horrible when I was doing a crowdfunding, going, hey guys, can I have some money? But actually, when people do it to you, you don't mind at all.
No.
So it's just getting in that mindset, which is tough.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are you coping?
Am I coping?
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm just very stressed. I think I feel overwhelmed. I think what I have to do, so I just like, in my diary wrote like a marketing plan to do every day, because I've basically been in circles, just like responding to this person on there, posting on here, messaging everyone on this and this. And it's like, no, I'm going to block out time. And then, cause I haven't had time to relax and I'm getting sick and I'm going to Sundance, so I can't be sick.
No. And that is the thing, isn't it? It's that mental health side of it that's been great in the last couple of years that we've been talking about it. But it's true. The burnout is a killer. It's really difficult releasing a film. It's really tough, especially if you haven't got a big team behind you doing it and they're telling you where to go and what to do. Yeah, it's no one. It's just you. Mm-hmm. And most of the time it is that. Even if you do have a big studio behind you or a big distribution company, you've still got to do it yourself. People rely too heavily on other people doing stuff. And no one does.
I knew not to do that.
Good. You learnt the hard way in a good way, because you've directed before, right? You made another film called Crave. Is that?
That was like a. So I actually made that after this. That was a short film that I co-directed with my friend, but it was really his vision. I just helped him because he hadn't directed.
I see.
That's more his thing.
Right. So this was your debut. Reflect is your debut,
and you've not directed anything.
So you've not directed a short before?
Well, okay, so I'll tell you a secret, and I'm fine telling people this, but the Wanna Hear a Story short that's on my IMDb that's a terrible short. My boyfriend directed that, but he let me say like I was co-director just so like investors thought I directed something.
Yeah, no, but that's fine. It's playing the game, right? This is an industry where you have to play the game, and you don't want your investors to look you up and go, well, you've directed nothing. At least you can say, well, I've directed that, but it's not finished yet. It's playing the game.
So besides that, all I did was listen to like podcasts like yours. I watched master classes, I read books, and then I just did it.
See, it's kind of the thing I've been saying, you know, on the podcast and saying for a while, is, and that's why I love your story.
Yeah.
Is because you were just like, oh, well, I'm just going to go do it. I'm going to do it. What's been the most, looking back now, and we're diving straight in, but what has been the sort of the thing you've learned the most? Like, is there something that's way bigger than everything else?
So many. Yeah, but I think, like, if I had to distill it down, like, a number one thing, like, and it's such a multidimensional statement, but be yourself. Like, love yourself, be yourself, listen to yourself. This is your vision. You're the only expert at your vision. Everyone's going to try to change you. Everyone's going to have an opinion. People are going to tell you you can't do things. Like, just if you trust and believe that you're the one to shepherd your vision, like, you don't need anyone else's belief. You really. So that was the biggest guiding light for me, because I had so much going against me. That was the thing I've learned, to be myself and not try to be like anyone else, to not. Feel shame that I'm not like anyone else, to not be upset that I didn't do a specific genre like people told me to. Like, I need to trust the universe and my path and follow my heart, and I don't know where that's going to end up, but I'd rather do that than doing like a specific thing that, yes, success might come, but it's not living my truth.
I love that.
Yeah,
that's so cool, because we can get bogged down in woulda, shoulda, coulda. I could have made this. So I should have made it more horror. Should have made it more sci-fi. Mm-hmm. All this, that all the distributors probably said, well, we don't know how to market it, or where should we put it? And you go, no, I made the film I wanted to make.
Yes,
right?
And I did.
That is important. You're proud of it. And you, at the end of it, you mm-hmm. go, look, this is what we've made. This
yeah.
is it. And yeah. And that's so great that you're saying, be you, you know, don't lose sight of that.
No.
That's, yeah, that's really important. Well, let's, yes. Right, reflect. I really enjoyed yes. it. I thought,
oh, thanks.
You know, for a debut movie, with everything around it, that aside, I thought yeah. it was really interesting. I thought
thanks.
It was really fascinating, you know, the
thanks.
Spiritual journey of enlightenment
yes.
and friendship and the
yes.
things that can go wrong in life.
Yes.
And, you know, I was like, fair play. This is really cool. It's
thanks.
A really, really well-made film.
Thanks.
What? Let's talk about the journey then from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Was when did the idea for you to, because you're an actress, you're doing very mm-hmm. well as an actress. When was the idea
thanks.
For you to direct? What was that moment? Was mm-hmm. there a moment? Where did it come from?
Yeah. So I almost went to film school when I was 20, but I ended up going to rehab instead. So I think this is like,
I mean, yeah, it's the same thing in some ways.
Yeah. And well, the thing is, instead of getting my film degree, I got my depth degree. So I learned
yeah.
a lot about myself and mental uh-huh. health and life, and had mm-hmm. a lot of experiences after that. Anyway, it was a dream I've always had ever since I was a kid, to make stories, to act, to be famous. I just didn't know how it would all happen. Now it's more about saving the world. I'm just being honest that that's what I used to think. Until I realized, you know.
Yeah. But how, I love that. The honesty is the fact that you're saying, you know, that's what you wanted to be, famous.
Yes.
And now you're saying,
now it's not, it's so funny. Like the more and more I get into this, the least and least, like the less and less I want that. And the more and more I just want a platform to share my metaphysical ideas, but the nothing to do with fame. I just want my beliefs out there, and I want to help people not feel alone. And I want to help people connect with themselves and love this beautiful planet we're on. And, you know, I'm always going to say, like, don't follow anything I say, but like, if something resonates, go for it. You know, mm-hmm. but always listen to yourself first. I'm not going to be one of those crazy metaphysical leaders who's like, listen to everything I say, do this. But sorry, I get crazy.
No.
Back to film.
Yes.
So I was acting in LA. I came
yep.
here when I was 30. I was in mm-hmm. mental health for 10 years before that.
Oh, you were working in mental health?
Yes.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. And then because of what you were going through, you put yourself to rehab.
Yes.
That was the moment you went, right, I need to go to rehab and change.
So when I was a teenager, I had very bad mental health and substance abuse issues. I went to rehab mm-hmm. at 21. And then 16 and 21. And then when I was 21, I really did turn my life around. Ever since, I haven't struggled with addiction, which is amazing.
Yeah.
And then through that, I wanted to help other people. So I got into the field of addiction and mental health. I was working and helping people. And after 9 years, I realized I'm only helping people that have health insurance. This is corrupt. Like every field has a dark side. And I was like, this isn't doing it for me. I'm not helping the amount of people I want to help. This is BS. And I was like, I can help people for cheap making movies. Like, yes, it's more stressful on me, but someone could afford a $3 movie and learn all these things I want to say, and I can reach more people. So with my ideas on the world. So, yeah, when I came here and I was an actress, I didn't have much agency over my career, and I'm a control freak. So I was like, I'm going to be a director writer. That's
well,
what
control,
happened.
Control your own destiny, right? I mean,
yeah.
in the way, when I was acting, it wasn't my main reason for becoming a director. But as soon as I did, it was like, oh, I can control the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And it was originally to put myself in stuff. And then I realized I love directing and producing and making stuff more than acting, and just
same.
Transitioned. But that was the reason, the same thing. I was like, it's a control freak in us that made me go, okay, the way to control it is to write, produce, direct stuff yourself. You can then put yourself in stuff, right? That makes total sense.
Yes. And I can make more complex female characters, more complex male character, not just about female, male characters too. Like, there's just a certain depth that was missing from the scripts I was reading. And there's amazing scripts out there, but as a starting out actress, you're not reading those.
Yeah, you're not getting offered those. Yeah, it's really
yeah.
tough.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So you're.
Yes.
Where did. Okay, so that moment, was there a moment where you found mm-hmm. that you're in LA, you've got this work coming, there's bits, but as a mm-hmm. jobbing actor, it's few and far between, or suddenly there's a rush, and you think, right, that's it, this is the one that's going to get me, and then it doesn't come out for 2 years, and you're mm-hmm. in that place. Mm-hmm. Was there a specific moment when you said, right, this is it, I'm going to write and direct this one, and this yes. idea of Reflect?
Yeah, yes.
Go on.
So... nothing to do with the movie I was filming. I was filming a movie called Hellhounds, which actually came out the same day as my film.
I know. Isn't that?
Yeah.
I read that. That was amazing. How funny.
Yeah. And very, very nice director. I love Robert Conway. But mm-hmm. when I was doing that film, and he'll get this, it was nothing about his film. I was in all night shoots and I was extremely depressed and we were shooting long hours and I was just acting and something in me was just like, I don't know, like I wanted, I would have to wait when I would come to set because I was just the actress. And something in me was like, I was having fun watching them film it. And something in me was like, I want to be like controlling the set and I want to be making the stories and maybe I'll act in some, but like, I just found myself gravitating to the other side of stuff and the storytelling. So I was very depressed because I hadn't seen like the sunlight in days. And I went to Sedona to get a little mental health break after shooting. Mm-hmm. And I just figured out there, like, I'm going to write and direct a movie and I'm going to film it in Sedona. Just like this revelation came over me. And then it all snowballed. Like, literally, I went home, talked to this one director who was like, yeah, make a movie about girls going on a trip. I was like, yes, Sedona. And then it all snowballed. And then it happened. I literally filmed the movie 3 months later. Like, it happened that fast.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
sometimes it needs that. It needs that kick up the ass.
Yeah.
A lot of people talk about making movies. A lot of people say, hey, I'm going to go make a movie. Mm-hmm. But very little people go and go make one after 3 months of deciding that. Because
yeah.
usually, because it's money, difficulties of getting cast people together. There's so many problems, issues.
Yeah.
I think it's amazing you went and did that in 3 months. How did you go about it then? Mm-hmm. How did you do it? How? Mm-hmm. Talk us from the very beginning of you going, I'm going to do this. Mm-hmm. to actually being on set. Talk us through that whole prep process, getting the team mm-hmm. together.
Yeah, so I think the number one thing, which it was, because now I'm making my second film and getting it going, I've lost this and I have to get back to it. I had beginner's mind. Mm-hmm. Like I approached everything in almost like an ignorant way to where like I just thought I was doing it. And I did doubt it a lot, but I didn't take that as reality. I just knew it was happening. It was that simple. So I wrote the script in like August, September. Mm-hmm. I maybe did 2 edits on the script, barely edited it. I was just like, oh, this is good. I'm going to make this. And then it felt like my truth. So no matter how good or bad the structuring was, I was like, it feels true. And that's all I care about is truth. Mm-hmm. You know, like entertaining people, hopefully that'll be figured out later. But I care about truth. So I did that. And then I was like, okay, I need to get like a crew together. I need to get, and okay, what do I need for a crew? I need to get money. So I was like, okay, money first. I watched a bunch of master classes about film. I read the book Story while I was writing my mm-hmm. script. I have some books here, so I'm just looking at them. I also was reading The Heroine's Journey, which was a feminine story structure that inspired my script a lot. Mm-hmm. Then when I was crowdfunding, I read The Energy of Money, which really helped me get in the mindset of not limiting beliefs. So I think like the best thing for directors to do is read books kind of on like breaking your limiting beliefs about that you can't raise money and can't do those things. So yeah, I made a crowdfund and I did not even worry about like who will make fun of me or who won't want to donate. I was like, I just was delusional. I was like, people are going to donate to this. They're going to support it. This is great. Like, I can't wait to make this film. just ignorant.
Yeah.
So I made the crowdfund for like $20,000 or something like that. And then mm-hmm. we got the funding in like a month.
Great.
And you know, I did do a lot of work. I messaged people on like LinkedIn for 10 hours a day, 8 hours a day. I was messaging people constantly. I was facing rejection constantly. I pushed past that. Like, and the biggest thing was just I kept going with all the doubts in my head that I did have, like, with some stuff. Not with raising money, though, for some reason. And then once I got the money, that's all I had. And I was able to at least like secure crew and cast with that. But I didn't have, so we needed $50,000 to shoot, and I didn't know where the rest of the money was coming from. And then I'm trying to remember how this happened. So as I was securing cast and crew, and I was my own line producer, so I kind of, I once again, I don't know how I did this, but I was just like, okay, I definitely will need a first AC to pull focus, and I'll need a cinematographer. I'll need one grip and gaffer, maybe two PAs, which will be like me and Ryan, who was my boyfriend at the time and producing it with me and my partner in this. And I'll have someone donate all the camera equipment, who I name my executive producer. So I'll get that all for free and give him exec producer credit. And then I'll pull favors. I'll lie to Sedona and tell them that I have a crew of 10 instead of 15. And it's $150 a day for a permit. All these things. I'm very good at math, and I think I'm a bit neurodivergent. So I'm very, I get very obsessive. So yeah, anyway, I made that all. And then I went out to crew and cast. Sorry.
No, this and is then, amazing. How did you know to do that? How did you know that, you know, to line produce and set a budget? Was it just from experience of being on set and asking questions? And like you say, reading books and listening to podcasts?
It was a mix of all that, but it literally just came natural to me. Like, I can line produce all day, and I have never done it professionally, but because I want to do it for my own stuff, but maybe because I need money now, I'll do it for other people. But time is more important than money to me. But yes. I can't explain it. It was like channeled. I just did it, and the numbers all worked. The days of shooting all worked. The amount I like down to the hour, I'm very intuitive. I did like 15 minute increments or how long things would take to shoot, and it just all worked. We got the shooting done every day. Like, I could show you my, this journal I made, this is like how I made the film, just so you can see. I don't even know what this is, but I would like, you know, there's like scene number.
So for I our listeners, like, so you've
seen. Yeah, this. Oh, sorry.
So for this our listeners, Dana's got a page, locations needed, and she's written down the side numbers and then which locations there are. Okay, cool. Yeah. And then on the other side, shot lists. By the looks of it, what shots you'd need.
Yeah, and then what state we're filming in, like specifics. Like, I just broke it down to everything. And then shooting, like, how many days we would need to shoot in each location. Each scene, how long it would take for the day. And then a lot of our scenes were outside and didn't need lighting. But the funny thing is, I didn't take into account lighting. So I would have got screwed on that. If we were filming inside, because then the times wouldn't have came out. But anyway, everything just worked.
Yep.
I don't know how I did this.
Like beginner's luck, like you say, that beginner's thing of sometimes just going, it'll work. Well, I think it'll be this long, so it'll be this long.
And yeah.
Sometimes it is, because once you set a date, a time, a thing, it becomes real. A DP or cinematographer might come and say, actually, this is probably going to take long, because it'd be better to shoot this when the sun goes down, or that location's moved to the afternoon. All that good stuff. But your intuition, I feel, as a director, as a filmmaker, is the most important thing. And you went with that. And it's kind of lovely to see. You know, so many filmmakers say this, that their first directing gig, where they were the most free. Because they just went, they don't know. They don't know what's right or wrong. They're just chucking it out and saying, well, this is what I want to do. And tell me if I'm wrong. But if no one tells you, you just do it. It's only later you start getting bogged down in, trying to make things better, or trying to repeat, or trying to, you're just constantly trying to recreate that first moment of magic when it just happened.
It was magic. And I hope I can... This actually talk is like motivating me to like rewire how I'm approaching my film that I'm working on now, because I was so focused. Like, I didn't do anything else but this for 3 months. I was so like, this was my reality. I was delusional, and it worked. I was in a state of magic. I was reading beautiful books on like philosophy and the divine feminine and money energetics, and it was just a really magical time. Post-production was not as magical, but shooting was magical. And
We'll get to that. Tell me about the other 30 grand that you had to raise. How did you go about that?
So this is magic too. So I literally made on LinkedIn. I have a bit of a following. I love LinkedIn. I tell everyone they should get investors off there. I also read books about like how to speak to investors. So I posted on LinkedIn that I'm making a film. This is my directorial debut. It's about women and mental health, spirituality. I literally get a message from a guy that goes, this guy, Michael O, and he goes, I invest in films like this. He was like, give me your number. Let me call you. I would love to help. We talk on the phone. I'm not joking. For 15 minutes, he wires me $30,000.
Holy.
And it was real. It was not a scam. And it could have been like looking back, but it was. I met.
Yeah.
Yeah. I met him and his wife.
Of people who were scared, you know, a lot of people saying, yeah, hey, I'd love to meet you. Love to. Really eggy and awkward. Did you, what did you offer in return?
So I think I was like confused at the time. I think so he was like, well, he's very smart. He's a businessman too. He was like, all right, so I'm the only investor, right? And I was like, yeah. He's like, okay, so I'll have 100% of the investor's equity. And I was like, yeah. And I mean, he got that, but that's like, that was his incentive that he wanted to be the only investor. So if the film does well, he'll get all that back. Of course, like I figured out later down the road, I needed more money, but then I just had to like, you know, I'll talk about that after, but that's how it happened. That's what he got, 100% of the investors pool, you know, and then, you know, we get the other half of that for the producers pool.
Yeah. After so the people who don't know, once it's made its money back, the full 100% that this investor will get, then after that, it then gets split. Normally, investors get 50% of whatever's after that.
And
the producer pool is the other 50. It doesn't have to work like that, but it's usual.
Yeah. So he would get his 30 grand back. He'll get his money back first. When he is all paid up, then we'll split it 50-50.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But did not have your, sorry to interrupt you, but did you also not have your
businessman,
but also the crowdfunder people, did you have like t-shirts or DVDs or things that cost money as well to give back? Or were you just literally asking for money on your crowdfunder?
No, I didn't give anything back. I told people I'd write them poems, and I wrote them poems because I talked to a lot of friends.
Poems are free, right? Yeah. Whereas DVDs and t-shirts are not free. Yes.
Yeah, I cannot do. I mean, I was good at, I talked to a lot of my friends. Actually, do you know Chloe? She produced The Last Rite.
Yes, Chloe's amazing. Chloe Chidasoma. So, yeah.
So I love her. She's the one I talked to before making my film, distributing my film, and she was ahead of me with her. So she gave me so much amazing advice about what not to do. So she's like the best. But
she's
anyway,
amazing,
what was I saying? Oh, crowdfund. Oh, investor. So anyway, we had the 50,000 a shoot, and that was once again magic and intuition, which is a common theme in this. Obviously, it's not always all logic. And then the other 50,000 that it ended up being in post-production and deliverables was me and Ryan put in money that we made from the state from COVID. And then I got some donations from mental health rehabs.
Wow. So the total budget came to about 100 grand in the end. Okay. And but you, because you, I say that's really interesting, isn't it? That that investor for the 30K was getting 100% back of the whole budget. Yeah. And that's where it gets tricky, right? I can see your hand on your face now going, yes, I've learned. I've learned, which is a good thing, right? It's not a good thing, but it's good that they were probably cool about it. And everyone was like, okay, don't worry. And as long as you're honest, I think, in this industry and say, look, I might have made a mistake here, but is there a way we can make this work?
He would have done it.
Yeah, he would have done it. And I think that's what...
He's an amazing guy.
There you go. And I think it's where people come into problems is where they deny that they've made a mistake or they've done it wrong or they got the numbers wrong. They're incorrect. Someone else's fault. It's like this business is constantly full of other people's faults. And actually, sometimes it's like, yeah, hold our hands up. We're new at this. Don't know. We've just... We need some money and this is how we wanted to work it.
Yeah.
And it, like you say, you learn and you go, okay, how do we do it better next time? And you hope those people come on the journey with you next time.
Yes. Right? Yes. I made a lot of mistakes on this film. Like I didn't even like this film when it first came out. I love it now. I really do. But like I was so hard on myself.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about, right, you've raised the money, you've done it, you've done all this amazing prep, you've written all your notes, you've talked to your DP, and maybe we'll come, I'm sure there'll be problems along the way in terms of locations and shooting all that kind of stuff. You know, there's a lot of time in the desert, there's a lot of bits and pieces for you to shoot.
Yeah.
Your directing process then, because not only you're directing, producing, written it, but you're also in it, and in it a lot. You're the lead role, I would say. So how did you manage that? You're shaking your head now.
There's so much chaos. And yeah, I mean, I'll literally probably won't. I won't never act in my own film again. But like, I love directing so much that I want to be able to really like shepherd the next story I do. It was too stressful. So like, how did I deal with that? The things where I feel like I fell short I was in the scenes most of the time. So I felt like I couldn't direct the actors to the best of my ability. Like if I wanted to redo something or try things a different way, I was not able to be an observer in those moments. So, you know, I feel like I would be a better director in the future if I was just directing and not acting in the scene with them, because I wasn't able to be as like objective.
Yep. I felt exactly the same way after I made my first short as a director, and I was in it and I hated it. And I just vowed I'm not going to do it again. I just didn't like it until, you know, I'm not Ben Affleck or, you know, Bradley Cooper. You know what I mean? So it's like, and plus they've got the team and the money around them. You know, we haven't. It's kind of, I hate it. I hate myself. Yeah. So I get what you were same. Feeling. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But how did you manage it? Like, say, you were probably in the scenes going, oh, gosh, I've got to think about this or that. Or, you know, should we get a close-up? Should I do this? And therefore, it takes you out of the scene, I suppose, in some way.
Yeah. So I did do, like, crazy manic prep to where I knew everything we were shooting. And, like, I just knew the timing was going to work. That never bothered me. The things that bothered me was it was 30 degrees. It was the middle of winter when no one else was there. It was freezing in Sedona that year. I think what also scared me was like worrying if the girls were okay. It was really hard to emotionally check in with everyone every day, the girls and the crew, where I was also trying to like keep myself together, worrying about, and like, you know, there were times where I had to change the shot list because it rained one day outside. We had to change a whole scene. So yeah, I just felt like my biggest worry was like, I wasn't enough of like an emotional support for everyone. And then when I was in the scene, I was okay at being in it as an actor. But the two last scenes where I'm very emotional at the end of the movie, I had to go back and shoot those. So we actually filmed a completely different scene that was emotional, and I butchered it. It was a disgusting disaster, horribly acted. Took it out of the movie, rewrote the movie, went back and filmed it myself with a small crew 4 months later.
But do you know what? Sometimes that, It's they say it's like you write your film three times, when you're writing it, when you're on set, and then in the edit. And so when you look at something in the edit, you go, oh my god, what was I doing? Oh my god. And especially there, you can go, oh well, do you know what, I'm in charge here. I'm going to go and reshoot that bit. I'm not happy. And that's did you do any other pickups at the same time, or was it just that end bit?
We did some B-roll pickups, but that's it.
Yeah, but I love that process in the edit. People, I feel, especially when you're starting, I was so scared. I was like, oh my God, no, this has to be perfect. This first edit I'm handing in, anyone sees, has to be perfect. Mm-hmm. No, it doesn't. It has to make some sort of sense and be a film. But that's the point where you can magically pull things and change and put ADR in and reshoot a little bit, change the ending. Of course you can. All films do that.
I know. I was going to say, I know that now, but you should have seen me when I saw the assembly cut from my editor. I was this close to like, and I don't want to be morbid here, but like jumping off a balcony. I was like, I need to quit this. I need to disappear. I was like, this is trash because I didn't know how bad assembly cuts are. Like I just, because I had never made a film. So I was like, what the shit is this? And then thank God I was like, oh no, like, you know, we sculpt it and it, you know, all turned out, you know, there's still issues I think with it, but it all turned out way better than I thought. It was a complete disaster. I thought my life was over.
Yep. Yeah. I think most filmmakers do. I think every, like, who was he saying this the other day? Scorsese was saying exactly that. He hates the assembly cut. It's terrible. It's the worst. You feel like a fraud and you can't make films anymore. So, yeah, we all feel the same way. We all feel exactly that. But you've got to push through it. And it's great that you did, because now, look, you know, you've released a film that's excellent, and you know, you're already thinking about your next one.
Yes.
And that's important. Okay, so what on set, that was an issue, or not an issue, but you managed to overcome it in some way. I certainly think so. You seem to get the coverage. You seem to get, you know, you told the story because you prepped it within an inch of its life. What other issues did you feel you had on set?
Okay, a lot. So, like, well, one of the things was, like, I had this, like, view. I was like, I'm going to be, like, Terrence Malick, this movie will look like his, and I'm going to make it so dreamy, and I want it to be like a painting, so there's very maximum depth, and everything looks like a painting, and it's going to be still, and then, like, I don't know, I wish we had a Steadicam, is basically what I'm saying, because, like, the way I decided to shoot the film, I don't regret it, but, like, now as a director, I would have been way more intimate about how I shot it. I still think it was all, like... Okay, where's my diary again? I have to bring something up. Unless it's missing. What? Where did I put it?
Did you put it on the bed? Did you throw it behind you?
I don't know. Okay, well, I'll just tell you. So when I was making my film, I had this whole, like, I had this whole philosophy of starting with far away from the girls. And if, like, some girls on the right side, some girls on the left side, it means different things. Like, I think the left side was, like, more feminine. The right side was more masculine. The middle meant they're, like, innocent. We started with, like, 34 millimeter, like, 50, it's millimeter, right? That's how you say it?
Yeah.
50 millimeter shots. And then once they get into the desert, it went from 18 to 16 to 14. And then all of the hooded figures were supposed to be filmed in 12 millimeter. Wow. And then we would get closer to the girls as the movie goes on. So you feel like it's like opening up. Mm-hmm. I don't think friggin' anyone noticed any of these things. And I felt like I stuck very rigid to that and it didn't let me be as free. My point is, I wish I was more intuitive about the filmmaking when I was there, which I'm going to do in my next film. So that was a problem I had.
Okay, but you had a vision, and I think that is one of the most important things as a director / filmmaker, is if you've got to stick to your vision. If you start changing halfway through, then it becomes wishy-washy. You had a vision, and you told it, and it actually, now you've described that to me, I've gone, oh yeah, now I see it, because people probably won't mention it because you suck them into the film, you suck them into the story, and therefore, why would they mention it? By the end, you've got these lovely close-ups or this 12 millimeter where it's distorted and really interesting.
Yeah.
And now you've described it to me, I've gone, oh yeah. I remember doing the same on The Dare and no one ever mentioned it. Every single scene had a different camera angle, had a different voice or different point of view. Every single one. And I remember my DP, Andy Roger, I was like, oh, I've got to change it. I feel like we're sticking. He went, no, stick to the plan. You thought about this. It's correct. And I think you're the same, Dana. You were correct. We can always look back and go, yeah, I might not. I didn't need to be so rigid, sure. But
I think you're right.
Vision is important.
I think you're right. I think here, you know what was the biggest problem? Not ragging on anyone, because this was actually our first DP that did this, who ended up firing, but not our second DP. But he wasn't listening to me about the camera lenses. So I would be acting in it, and then I would come out, and I saw that he changed the depth, or he changed the lens because it looked better. And I was like, this is my frickin' movie. So I fired him. Mm-hmm. And I also learned, that was an issue on set, I learned, like, you don't have to be a bitch. You can do it with grace, but you also need to have boundaries as a director. You can't be a people pleaser. Mm-hmm. And if you hear someone's, you know, thinking they don't know what you're doing or not supporting your vision, they need to go, even if you're in the middle of the shoot. So that's something I learned. That was an issue.
And I think it's been, like you say there, it's just being bold. And if you're clashing with someone, a HOD that's really important to you and your film, especially if you're acting in it, you're trusting them and you're saying, well, this is the shot I want, please can you do that for me, and then they change it without telling you. That's just not on. It's just not how to do it. If they think theirs is better, they should talk to you about it and say, can I show you these two options? And I know you're probably up against it with time and all that kind of stuff, so look, it's your vision. It's your, at the end of the day, it's like, cool, you've got to go if you're not going to stick with what I want to do. It's your choice. The tone and the colors as well, let's talk about the palette and what you did, because I felt it had this, I felt there was specific colors that you had in there. Obviously there's a lot of yellow and blue with the desert and the sky, but also then there was the white and the red with what they were wearing, I suppose. But also I felt that you had this, you'd thought about that, so yeah, maybe talk about that whole process.
I was reading a lot of books about the divine feminine, Mary Magdalene, mythology, and white and red is a very, I'm not even going to say what it is because it's inappropriate, but it's like, it has to do with magic and alchemy, and it symbolizes like bodily fluids, but it has to also do with like the divine feminine. And here, you know what I could say? It's like mother's milk and blood, I think it was. But there's a lot of like undertones and magical, mythical undertones. And it's about women awakening, coming into their divine feminine. So it just felt like the symbolism was there for that. And like they're kind of dressed in white, very innocent. I didn't want a movie about like pretty attractive girls. I wanted a movie where like they basically were wearing things that didn't distract you too much and that it doesn't matter what angles we're doing on the face. It's about the emotion, not about how they look.
Yep.
That was extremely important to me. And then the colors, when they got to the desert, they get more vivid. I love vivid colors and sensory things and metaphysical filmmaking. And I just wanted things to pop, like where, you know, like we're sensing things more than we usually do. So that was kind of my thing behind color theory. And then, yeah, I mean, that was it with the white and the red. I'm trying to think of like Hermes. He was dressed as the tarot card guy. And Hermes is also an interdimensional traveler. In mythology.
So yeah, it seemed like you put so much thought and effort into it, and it sort of spooled out onto the screen, in my opinion. This wasn't just something where people had just gone to a desert and gone, okay, well, let's make a film. It felt really thought about and really considered, and it felt like you worked really hard on the movie. You could feel
it. I did. I worked harder than it looks, I even feel like. I'm trying to go through my diary because I just found it. And I'm trying to read if I had any, I should have done this before we spoke, but if I had any other notes. Oh, so I have something that I wrote down, which was like the vibe of the movie. I'm just going to read out words
to
you.
Yeah, read out the words. There's a lot of words on a page for our listeners here. Right.
Yeah.
Here.
So this is director vibe.
Yeah.
Empowering, heart guides me, realizer, good vibes, vibrational, rest, ancient wisdom, higher self, goddess, timeless. Listen to myself, discovery, meditation, breathing, rest. I don't know. I was just writing like words. I think the film was meant to be like more of a subconscious cellular thing. And the more you watch it, the more you discover. And, you know, this was more like a mystery school than a film. I get it's not for everyone, but yeah.
Well, were you using some of those words there to talk to your actors? Like, you know, when you weren't in the scene specifically, maybe the scenes, you know, the character, I've forgotten his name, sorry.
Like like the ones without me?
Yeah. The
like with all the other girls?
Yeah, well, not with yeah, there are a lot the of girls, names. But also the boys as well. The two felt like father and son, but they probably weren't. I can cut around.
Oh, God, I don't even remember the names of the characters. Beale and his dad.
Yeah, exactly. Beale and his dad. For those ones, and with the girls in the scenes you weren't in, how did you talk to the actors? Because it can feel strange when you're on the same page, like when you're acting in the scenes as well. You know, they are your peers. It's very hard to sometimes, you know, pull a performance if you're not happy or change something. What did you do?
That actually is a difficult thing. And I probably won't work with friends as much. Like, I mean, we'll become friends through shooting, but, and obviously now though, having better like boundaries and discernment, I would be okay saying all these things that I actually didn't say in this shoot. But like, I was scared to give people redirections, particularly my boyfriend. I was nervous to give him redirections, where I wouldn't be nervous now. But I think I have a very gentle way of doing it. So like, if I didn't like a performance as far as like for my vision, I would say to them, like, that was great. Can we try it this way? Like just something simple like that. Like, oh, great. Even if I, you know, don't think it is great, but if it's not my vision, I like to give people other emotions to try. So I'll be like, okay, now do it angrier, do it more sad, or sometimes I'll get very metaphysical and I'm like, you know, you're 5 years old, you're talking to your younger self, what are you saying? Like, I like to be very simple, so I'll keep it to just a few words. Yeah, I don't like to be, because I can get on tangents, as you can tell. I don't like to do that to the actors.
Well, we can get bogged down. I think sometimes we can over-direct as directors. Yes. We start going, oh, well, let's have a huge conversation about something. And actually, the actors know, because you're an actor. So therefore, you go, when directors start doing it, you go, yeah, that doesn't really help me with the scene. So it's great that you come at it from that angle. Sometimes you've just got to be direct as well. And, you know, especially big directors, they don't often direct. You know, Ridley Scott very rarely says anything to the actors. You know,
I don't either.
Right. And sometimes it's their performance. So you've already talked about it in rehearsals or you've done the blocking. Sometimes it's one word. It could be, think demeaning, or it could be anything.
Yes.
Or, you know, be flirtier or whatever it is. It's something tiny that just makes them go, oh, yeah. Rather than beat by beat by beat, which can get their brain bogged down. They look like they're acting rather than just being an emotional in the scene. So, yes, it's always a tricky thing. Very tricky. In terms of lenses, then, in terms of with your cameraman and or woman, and interestingly about when you had to remove them from set, did that mean that the camera went? And how did you talk to them generally, I suppose? There's two questions in one. Sorry.
Yeah, it all worked out. I got really lucky because the camera equipment was free from my executive producer, who was also on set.
So it wasn't the DPs. Right. Okay, fine. Okay.
Yeah. Good. And then the lenses were actually brought in by our sound guy. So thanks to him. So we got all, you know, I think he did have some lenses, but we weren't really using them a lot. So, yeah. And, you know, I really do have a big heart. So, like, I even felt bad letting him go. But, like, I just couldn't keep someone on set that was, you know, saying mean things about me, trying to change my vision. Like, you know, I don't know. I had to trust the people that told me that that was happening. Besides that, there was zero drama, though. So it was, like, the smallest blip. But did you have another question or did I answer it?
Yeah, no, you answered that one. And stupidly, I put two in one. But the second question was, how do you talk to your camera team? How do you know about lenses? Being an actor, I didn't. It took me my first thing that I directed, I had no idea. I was kind of just going, well, I want it to look a bit closer or further away. And I had to learn now what a 35 millimeter is or 50 or 75 and what the difference that does to the image and why it's saying something different. Each lens says something differently. How did you get around that? How did you feel like you knew what you were talking about? Because it can feel daunting.
Mm-hmm. I'm very visual. Like, I'm way better at expressing through visuals than through me talking, I guess. And I knew I had, like, a same thing, an intuition for lenses. I didn't know anything about them. I knew what I wanted it to be like. So I tried to look up their language and I just looked up the lenses. I Googled what different lenses looked like in different millimeters. And then I looked up about some different lenses, like, before we shot. And then I was able, like, I shot less of the whole thing with lenses. So unfortunately, this wasn't, like, really the DP's vision. It's more like they were more of a camera person, which is, and then they did also give their advice on things. Like, Bernie Tarrant was great, but as far as, like, the actual cinematography and the lenses, like, that was all I shot listed the entire thing, knowing I was doing that. Like, next film, I'm definitely excited to collaborate with the DP before the film, because I did not get that experience, like, how this film worked, because I was, like, desperate for people. I met, you know, DP number one, who I won't name. I don't even think he read the script. He pretended he did. Wow. He was like, let's go shoot this. He said he would do it for cheap. So I hired him. We went to shoot it. Things fell apart. I got Bernie on. Thank God I had made, like, basically a DP shot list. And then he just shepherded my film. He also had some great ideas and did a good job.
Yeah. There you go. I love that. I love that you Googled it and worked it out yourself and went, well, this feels right to me.
Yeah.
And that's great. And then when you get a DP like Bernie come on board to go, yeah, that's great, but could we try this? Can I suggest?
He would ask me.
Yes. Right.
And he also read the script. I think he was on as a PA or, like, a gaffer. I don't remember what I hired him as, but I might have been a PA. I'm not even joking. And he actually was a DP and he offered to do it. It was, like, meant to be.
So he was already on set?
Yes, yes.
Oh, perfect. So you'd already had the conversation saying, look, I want rid of him. He said, well, actually, I can DP. I love it. And you went, yes, this is happening. I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because he read the script and actually could talk to me about it. And as a PA, I was very impressed he did that.
And I love that you, in a way, took a chance, because it's actually really brave to remove someone from a film set. It's actually really traumatic and hard, and it comes with so much baggage, and you feel like your whole world is collapsing, and are people going to be on your side or not? And actually, at the end of the day, it's all about the film. We forget that sometimes, and it's the vision and getting that across. And we do have to remember, if it's not working, it's not working for a reason. And we need to depart for whatever reason. It's not this project we're working on together. So well done. It's, you know, it is difficult. Okay, cool. So that was set. pretty much.
Yeah.
And then you got to post and you looked at the edit and you said, okay, I'm not happy, but I'm going to do pickups of certain bits. But how did mm-hmm. you find the whole edit process? You know, being the first time coming into something mm-hmm. like that.
I feel like once again, I completely messed that up too. Like,
yeah,
my poor editor, like he was also having twins at the time and like he did it for a discount. So, like he did not have like a full time to do this. Mm-hmm. I completely get that. I was always bothering him to just finish it quicker and quicker, which everyone wants done. He just could not do that. And it makes sense why I was not paying him to work full time.
No, is this Caden?
No. So that's the one. Caden and Marissa picked it up after this guy when he had twins. This is Spencer.
Spencer. Right. Okay.
Yes. And he's a great editor. He literally just did not have the time and bandwidth for what I was paying him and with his twins coming. So he got it to where it needed to be. And then I had my friends, Kate and Marissa, kind of add like flair to it, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like, we just had a different dynamic, me and Kate and Marissa, because they're like my close friends and I can just like bully them a little bit more. Where Spencer, you know, I was paying him, but not that much. I didn't know him that well. So I was like, I was honestly like, I wish I spoke up more because I think I was nervous sometimes to say things.
Yeah.
But I mean, not in like, you know, he wouldn't know. It's all about communication. But he's a great editor. And he was like a wizard with Adobe or whatever he was, Premiere Pro. Mm-hmm. But anyway, my biggest fault in editing was that I rushed the edit because I just wanted to screen my movie for people. So I made the screening date in September. Oh. And I was like, I made my own stupid like end date. I was like, I have to get it done. And I'm rushing all these people on post. And then like, there's so much more finessing I could have done, but because mm-hmm. I wanted it done by this time, that's like what happened. It's kind of funny.
Is that I totally hear that because so many people rush it. They honestly, they go, I've got a film and I want to show people because people are asking them, you know, mm-hmm. it can take, you know, The Dare, my first movie took 3 years from principle to it actually coming out. And in mm-hmm. that whole time, you know, if anyone asked me, I felt like a failure. I felt like one day, you know, it felt like it'll never come out. So that whole time I want to show something. Please let me show something. Please let me. So I hear it all the time from first time.
That's what
directors.
I did.
Yeah. They go, I need to screen this. I need to show people. I'm going to cut a trailer. I'm going to relax.
I regret it so much.
Everyone regrets it when they rush it. Everyone.
Why didn't I do a screening when the movie came out? Like, exactly. What was I thinking?
Then people will go, that was great. Rather than doing it, everyone goes, oh, yeah, no, this is it. Because people don't think you're going to change it. People just think that's the end product. And I say you get three chances with this, with your filmmaking, with anyone. The first time you mm-hmm. show them anything, which is usually mm-hmm. the trailer. The mm-hmm. second time is when you show them post, and the third time is when it comes out.
Yeah.
That's it. After that, you're just rehashing the same stuff again. Mm-hmm. If you drop stuff too early, people think they've seen it, especially if you drop something a year before it comes out.
People done that.
There you go. Right? And it doesn't work because people can't click the button to buy it. They'll only do it once. They'll only look at it once. They won't look at, oh, I've seen that trailer. Oh, I'm not bothered.
Yeah. No, so, everyone's so over me. I've been talking about this for 2 years. They're like, we saw this last year. I'm like, no, you didn't.
Yeah, he's like, you haven't seen it. You saw a bit of it and it's new and we've changed it. Yeah. No, people by then have gone, yeah, but I've seen it and I didn't really like it because you haven't finished it. There was no finesse. Yeah. There was no music or score or there was no sound bed or, you know, the VFX. There's all these things missing, you know.
I was going to say, the funny thing is, I raced to finish it. Yeah. Like, for me, it was the finished film. So, like, people saw it, but it wasn't. So, what I did was I made a screening. And I will say, like, I was being tactical. Like, the buzz of that, I think, helped me get a distribution deal. So, like, I invited, you know, industry people, a bunch of people. And then, you know, I had a couple offers on my film, nothing like crazy, but I think it was meant to be that way, but it's still, I would never ever do that again.
Right. Yeah. Did you then, after you rushed to finish mm-hmm. it, did you then change it?
No.
Right. Okay. Right.
That's the film. That's why I look at it and I cringe because there's like, just for me as a filmmaker, like I know I could have done way better. Like I could have finessed it so much more. It still came out how it's meant to be and everything happens for a reason.
Mm-hmm. I thought you showed it too early, but we're still in the edit or VFX. No, you rushed.
Yes.
See, that's the thing. Why do you think you rushed?
Oh, I can tell you right now, because I wasn't as far along in therapy as I am now.
Right.
Yeah, I was a little bit desperate. I was impatient. I was anxious, attachment disordered. I was needing validation, approval. I was needing, wanting friends, wanting people to like me, wanting to, people to see that I did something. Just so many things outside validation that I could care literally almost less about now. Like, all I care about now is like what the fans of the movies think and what. Like the fans, though, the supporters, and what I think. That's all I care about. I will take everyone's opinion for sure. And I think there's a lot of people way smarter than me, but the only person that needs to validate me is me.
I love it. Beautiful. And so right. And interestingly, for your next film, what I've found as well is people don't often watch your back catalogue. You know,
Oh,
so
good.
they don't often go, oh,
Just
well, I
kidding.
must watch the whole film. They'll watch the trailer. They'll look at the new film, what you're presenting them, and your vision for the new film, and then judge it on that. And then maybe later they'll, you know, you hook them in on, I did this. We made it for whatever, and I just ate it up. My director told me, I've done it. I've done it. What I really like in anyone is the fact that they've got off their ass and done it. As a producer, I've worked with directors, you know, who are second-time directors, but their first one, they're not proud of. They just did it. They made it for whatever. It's in their bedroom, however they did it. But for me, it meant that they went through the whole process. Because as a producer, going through it with a first-time director, like you're saying now, all those things I did, the things that, as a producer, you have to keep going, no, that's not how it works. No, that's not how it works. So if someone's done it, they go, yeah, you know. I say you don't have to say those things. It's really fascinating. You learn so much after making your first movie.
Yes,
So
I've grown
much.
up.
You've grown up. You've grown up. And now it means you can take all stuff you learned, and put it into your next film. And therefore, you can talk to your investors, your crew, your cast, based on those facts. And that's what's so important is, you know, get out there and make your first one. And then, yeah, then you can keep making films. If you don't make your first one, you're not making films.
No.
I love it. I love it.
Yeah, and we're only human. We're gonna mess up. We're gonna make mistakes. We're
Yes.
gonna not like ourselves. It doesn't mean we're not worthy of making another film. It doesn't mean we're not worthy of money. It doesn't mean we're not worthy of people liking us. All of those things. We're artists. This is art. Investors are taking risks. They're very aware of that.
Yes, most investors put money into films because they like the people involved in that film, and they want to take a little risk and tell people, hey, I put some money into a film. And if it's any good, they look great. If it's not, pff, doesn't matter. That's why you always try and find HNIs, high net worth individuals, who do have a lot of money. And therefore, it's just it's a holiday for them or something. They're the investors you want to find, not someone who this is their last, 10 grand.
No.
On that then, in terms of deliverables, because the deliverables, yeah, right? This is the thing a lot of filmmakers, when they're starting, don't understand. They don't get the deliverable side, how important it is to take stills and how important it is to get, all that kind of stuff. You need to, my God, the list goes on in terms of what you need, let alone talking about working with a distributor or a sales agent and working out all those contract goodies.
Oh God.
How
Oh
did
God,
you,
yeah.
what happened? Because you, like you say, you feel like you're rushed to get your film ready, and then you got cranked up films as your distributors or one of them. How then did you all the deliverables list that came? Did you just look at it and go, what do you want me to do? How did you approach that?
Yes. So this is the part where I do excel, even though I am impatient. Like, I'm a New Yorker. I used to have a food business. I'm good at business. I looked over the contracts. I worked with Rummel Law. They're a great law firm. They got me great deals. I talked to Chloe and a bunch of other people who worked with certain distributors, what their deliverables were before my film was shot, I think. So I knew like what to do, what to have. When I got the deliverables, I was very overwhelmed, but me and Ryan just did it one brick at a time. We got it done in 2 months, and we, used $10,000 more of ours to do that. So, but I knew that it would cost around that, like after speaking to people. So anyway, I was prepared for deliverables. And, between me and Ryan, we're pretty smart. He's good with technology. I'm good with numbers and business. So it all worked. Everything, it was actually like, it wasn't terrible, but it was just annoying that we had to spend more money on that. I know some distributors will give you some money for that. Ours didn't. And then as far as the contracts go, yes, I used a good lawyer. I also knew to ask for like a lower term length. I knew that like a 70-30 split was better than a 65-35. I didn't want a minimum guarantee. I knew mine film wasn't really worth one anyway. I don't have names in it or anything. I didn't have a certain genre. And then I capped the marketing budget, I think at like 10 or 15K. Right. That I know that's smart to do. Yeah. You know, just things I just knew to do certain things. And when I got, I don't know if I should say the company, when a couple other companies offered me deals that weren't like that, and like one of the companies wanted me to pay them to distribute, I was like,
what?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God. I've never heard that one. Yeah. Wow.
They were like, I wish I could say the company, but they were like, give us $5,000 and we'll distribute your film. I was like, no. I was like, I have offers for zero and they're going to give me something. They're like, oh, well, then we'll do that. I was like, no.
Yeah. No, now it's too late. Now I don't trust you in any way, shape or form. No, just for filmmakers, mm-hmm. they'll never pay money for a distributor to put your film out. That's Mm-mm. insane. They're already going to take money up front. And you know, some distributors out there are really good. There are some.
Yes.
And you've got to
yes.
find them. But there's so many sites now that will help you. There's yeah. Facebook sites for distributing for yes, filmmakers yes. that will, you know, there's lists of people who've been burnt by distributors. Well, I yes. say, and it's great that you'd already learnt this really on, and you and Ryan's mm-hmm. very switched on and clever. It's yeah. most filmmakers go, oh, I'm giving it to a certain distributors. They know what they're doing. They're going to help me make my film. But most of them, yeah. they're a business. And if they've yes. got a marketing spend of 10, 15 grand, well, the first 10, 15 grand that comes in is theirs. Anything after that, they have to split with you. So they're not going to work as hard for it. I mean, it's just business sense. So as long as you're yeah. savvy and understand that world, then you can negotiate mm-hmm. the contracts. It sounds like you did it really well.
Yeah. The number one rule I've learned in negotiating is if they leave the deal excited and you don't, you have lost. And if you leave the deal and they're just like, okay, you've gotten the better deal. And if you're both happy, then that's really exciting. But why are they so happy?
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. You also
a good deed was great.
Yes. That's great. That's good to know. And it's that, it yeah. is that fine balance of just not, people say they got ripped off or burned, but it's just understanding it. It's understanding it's business. They're not ripping you off. They're just going, oh, well, if they don't understand it, I'm going to put this in the clause. Any businessman yeah. does this in any walk of life. So you've just mm-hmm. got to be clever and go, okay, just don't go into it blind.
No.
Excellent. Excellent. What about in terms of like now promoting the movie? Mm-hmm. How have you found mm-hmm. that? What's worked for you? What hasn't?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'll know more obviously in a couple months, but you're the first interview I've had since my film has came out. Mm-hmm. So what I think this spiritual crowd loves our film. People who just want to see like action horror movies hate us. The critics like for those kind of movies are meanies. Mm-hmm. I don't really care. That's just a reflection yeah, of what they yeah, think about themselves. Yeah. whatever someone says reflects what they think about themselves. Because the guy wrote like, oh, it doesn't have much depth. I was like, get the frick out of here.
There's so much depth. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, that's like the one thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Interesting you said reflect there, because obviously it's called reflect as well, and people need to reflect on their actions. I also feel that there's a lot of keyboard warriors out there, and this is something yes. I've learned is, and it's still so hard, even now, even when I'm looking back yes. at something or I need a quote for some film I've made or whatever,
I know.
And you see the shit reviews and you just go, oh, and it hurts.
I know.
Yeah.
Yes, it does.
Kills you.
It makes me a little depressed.
Yeah, it makes you depressed every time. Then you just, sometimes I take an hour and just go, oh God, that hurts. Stop it. Don't look at it anymore. Stop. Because it just gets you. It yeah. doesn't matter how many good ones you read. It doesn't matter. You just focus
yeah,
on the bad
ones.
You don't believe the good ones, weirdly. I don't believe them. I'm like, oh yeah, well, they're obviously lying. They don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah. Well, I'm like, oh, I've tricked
yes,
them.
I've tricked them into thinking this is good. It's weird. It's so weird. Such a weird place.
Yeah.
What have you yes. found that worked for you, though, in terms of your promotion of the film?
Yes, sorry. Yes. So I did, you know, when I worked in mental health, I also worked in social media marketing. Mm-hmm. So I know the one thing I do know is my audience. So I had $0 to market, which is another mistake I made. Mm-hmm. I did not, you know, fundraise for marketing funds, but I know, you know, I've been posting on Instagram every day. So has the distribution company, but I don't just post. For all of us just posting, that does not work. I go in and I message targeted spiritual people. So I'll look at a spiritual influencer and I'll troll their followers and I'll message all of them. I try to message 30 people per day on each platform, because more than that and I'll just go crazy. Mm-hmm. So on LinkedIn, I'll message 30 of my followers a day, because my followers like mental health and spirituality. Yep. I'll message the Instagram people, and then on Facebook, I'll message people from my hometown, and then I'll go on Facebook groups and message people into spiritual groups. Mm. So anyway, I've done all that. Obviously, podcast still counts as marketing.
Yep, definitely.
I try to get on metaphysical podcasts. I think I have a few coming out. Psychology podcast. I know how to reach my audience. I wish I had the money to do it because, you know, I know. Yeah, the one thing I know is my audience, and I know there has been such a climb in spirituality and people feeling alone through COVID and discovering spirituality and psychology and metaphysics, and the entertainment industry has left them completely in the dust. Like maybe like Britt Marling's one of the only people that I know that caters to those kind of people, yes. And would love to be in her presence one day. She's influenced me. And then also like Justin Benson, Aaron Moorhead.
Oh, I love those guys. Yeah,
they cater to the crowd. But a huge, like, not a lot of people cater to this crowd, and there's millions of them. So, like, I just hope that I can prove that I can reach those people.
Yeah, and you will. Yeah. And does that mean your next film as well is going down the spiritual mental health route as well?
Yes. So, based on my learnings, it is a character piece on one woman who deals with grief. All I can say is it's a sci-fi plot about how she deals with grief and loss and has a spiritual awakening through that. There's a lot more to it, but it's a more contained story. It has even more depth. It also is nonlinear. There's a lot of cool stuff in it. That's as much as I can say.
That's exciting. And you even sound excited talking about it.
So I made Reflect to make this film. So I had written this script right before I wrote Reflect, and before I shot that movie, just wrote the script. I didn't know what I was going to do with it just because I like channeled it or whatever. And it's the first script I've ever written. So I'm so excited. And I made that movie first so I could make this film at a bigger budget.
Love it. Exactly. That's sometimes the way it is. The scripts we like the best doesn't mean we're making that now.
Yeah.
It might be 10, 20 next year. Who knows?
Yeah.
But sometimes we've just got to think, okay, I love this one, but this is a tough one to make. So it might be my next or my next.
Yeah.
But that's great. It means that now you're in a really cool place.
Yeah.
Very exciting. Very exciting indeed. I can't wait to see it. I can't wait to hear how you get on. And listen, really good luck with Reflect as well. Finally, I mean, you've given us so much, but that little bit of advice for someone who's about to go through what you did on Reflect, something that you go, I wish I'd done.
I'll say three things. Please. Steal this from Lewis Howe's podcast because he says like he has three questions or says like I can never just say one thing. three things. Number one, I would have been more kind to myself throughout the process.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very hard on myself. Number two, I'm trying to think of things I haven't said already in this talk. Mm-hmm. Number two, I would have checked in with my crew and cast more after filming.
Mm-hmm.
And number three, I already said this, but this is so important. I wouldn't have necessarily taken more time in post, but I would have been more detail oriented, more patient within that time frame. I would have spoken up more, just like been more patient within the time constraints of post, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does.
Yeah. That is. And can I speak really quick just on one thing in metaphysical film that I want to say?
Yeah.
Just like my goal, because I just want to put it out there. So like, my goal is to create a new genre in film, which is metaphysical film, which is like, you know, the movie Arrival or Waking Life, philosophical films kind of. And my next step within my next film will be to gear myself more towards optimistic futurism and sustainable filmmaking. So like where I'm going in my career is to make sure that I'm doing green filmmaking, which is being more sustainable and helping our planet. Because if I'm going to make movies to try to save our planet, I need to be doing it behind the scenes. And I think it's also so important to have a filmmaking team that exudes love and light, and you can be kind to people on set. You never need to be mean, no matter how high up you are. And those are just things I want to put out there. And I think that we're making new genres right now, and there's new ways to finance movies, and there's all this new coming in. So if anyone's coming into this and your way is different, go with that. Like, just follow the dark path, follow the yellow brick road and follow the void, because you're gonna bring new things into this world.
You couldn't put it better. And it's so important that you've said that as well. People feel afraid, or people try and pigeonhole you as a filmmaker, make a horror, make this. And you go, well, no, mine's a bit different, actually. Mine isn't that. And if there's an audience, there's an audience. And that's all that matters. So congratulations to you. I'm very proud of you. I loved your story. I love what you've done. I really enjoyed the film and what you've achieved. And like I said, I'm really looking forward to seeing what you do next, because that's the exciting time. So for those of you listening, you can go do what Dana has done. You can go out and make your film for very little money. You can raise money on a Kickstarter. You can get your friends in. You can get the support, the people around you. You can raise money on LinkedIn and wherever else. And if you're lucky enough to rise up and do well, it is your duty to send the elevator back down. We will see you next Tuesday, as always. Dana Kippel, thank you so much for your time.
Yes, thank you.
Take care, everyone. Bye.